Welcome to Hope Chapel. You're about to listen to Andrew Cole.
Well, welcome. We are doing our last covenant from the Old Testament before we head into the New Covenant next week. So this is the Davidic Covenant. Turn to your neighbour, say that. It's about looking forward, and it's about God's grace forever. Who loves God's grace? Who the grace of God is something like nothing else. It's you can't earn it. You can't buy it. It is a gift from God, and it is unbelievable. It's incredible. The unmerited favour of God, God's grace. And all this covenants, I've seen this whole redemptive story is all just laced with grace, the grace of God. Bringing it to a place one week at a time, or one covenant at a time for us. And this Davidic one is has been labelled as like a hinge between the old and the new. So this morning there's going to be a mixture of both. And I don't want to take all of next week away, but I want to lead into next week as well, because this is so... It just leans into it. It is what they say. It is a hinge into the old, into the new, to the temporary, to the eternal. And it's quite overwhelming. And unless you study these things, I guess, I don't think I've read so much in the last 6 months or a year since we've been wanting to do this. And I've read so much and confused myself and then put myself back together and then had to have a break from it all. But all through it all is just this incredible story. And it's changed my view. It's changed my relationship with God. It's changed my view on the Old Testament. It's changed the way I read my Bible. It's changed the way I pray. And I have this overwhelming gratitude. And I love that just of recent weeks we've been talking, or the guys up here have been singing and speaking a lot about gratitude. And I guess that's my heart is filled with gratitude. My heart is filled with the love of God because of this story of His unrelenting pursuit of us. And it's not just of others that we read about. It's actually personalized. It's God's unrelenting pursuit of you and your heart. Because that's what He wants. He wants your heart. Overwhelmingly wants your heart. So we're going to start off and we're going to read some scripture. Is that okay?
2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 12 through to 17. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up with your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son. If he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of children of men, of the children of men. But my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure for whoever before me. Your throne shall be established forever in accordance with all these words and in accordance with all this vision. Nathan spoke to David. Is that what you wanted?
Thank you, Michael. Very well done. So this prophecy of the Messiah took place about 1,000 years before the birth of Jesus. David was the king of the nation of Israel, and he had succeeded a not-so-good king, more of an evil king, named Saul, and after a long conflict. Because of Saul's wickedness, God had rejected him and chose David. Saul was jealous of David and had repeatedly attempted to kill him. And at this point, Saul was dead. And he was defeated in battle and took his own life. Not so great. David was the king over all Israel, which existed as 12 tribes. They were united under him, and he had begun to correct the mistakes made by Saul. And from the time God brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, he intended that they wouldn't be like other nations of the world. But 1 Samuel 8 says that they wanted to be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. This had always been God's role if they would only trust him, but they wouldn't. Israel is the nation of Israel. The Israelites were an incredible story of obedience and disobedience, going to God, going away from God. And it's just this repetitive nature. It's quite laborious, but I guess when you read it, then you start putting a mirror up. I don't have to say much more than that. So God gave them Saul. It was the king that they had to have, a king that they asked for. However, in his grace, he had now given them David. The appointing of David as king was a continuation of the covenant promises made to Abraham and developed further through Moses, or with Moses. The people of Israel were a great nation that God promised would come from Abraham. He gave them his law, which organized Israel as a nation, and they took and conquered land, but there was more needed. Israel was a free nation, but they wouldn't last forever. David would die and his son Solomon would become king. After Solomon, the nation would split and eventually each side would be conquered by rival nations. All of it was foretold by the prophets as they repeatedly warned the people that what was going to happen if they continued in their sin against God. We should interpret this in light of what happened before and what happened after. We also have to recognize like many other prophecies, there would be a partial fulfillment in more sooner and then a complete fulfillment later. It's sometimes misunderstood about biblical prophecy. For example, with the promise to Abraham that from his offspring would come a great nation, a partial fulfillment occurred in Isaac and his family and the nation of Israel. But as Galatians 3 explains, the complete fulfillment of that promise is in Jesus Christ. Ultimately, Christ would be the complete fulfillment of these promises to David, and actually in everything in our life. But there would be partial fulfillments in the near future, especially in Solomon. The covenants with Abraham and Moses emphasized physical blessings. They gave him land, they gave him fruitful land, they gave them other things. But the covenant with Christ emphasizes spiritual blessings. God's covenant here with David is the phase of transition between the two. The emphasis shifts from the temporal to the eternal, from now to forever, from the transient to the permanent. We are fixated on temporal things. We put our hope in things that we can see and feel. And when those things fail us, we look for the next one. And at some point, you have to wonder, are there any permanent things to put our hope in? Who here quite often looks for temporary things? Just the four of us. Through the birth of Jesus Christ, God gave us something permanent. In a world full of temporary things, he gives permanent things to those in covenant relationship with him, everlasting things to satisfy the longings of our hearts. I don't know where you're all at in life, in your journey, but I know even before I was a Christian, there was a longing. I didn't know what that longing was. I think the whole world who is not in relationship or covenant relationship with Christ has this longing that they don't know what to do with. And they pour their lives into it, something which is temporary. When we are created to be fixated or look to something with permanency, there is not one thing in this room that's got permanency on. No relationship, no building, no lights, no anything. It doesn't have anything that it's got a permanency to it. So what are those permanent covenant blessings of God? Well, I think there's three that we're going to look at today. His permanent protection. Everyone say protection, please. His permanent presence and his permanent love. The first one, protection. That sounded so corny, didn't it? I could hear it. It was just shocking. Under David, Israel was united, strong and secure, free from other nations. Rival nations always wanted to conquer Israel. David knew that he couldn't rule forever, but here God promised him a descendant who could rule forever. If we look at verse 12, or what we first read, when your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, that means you die, just in case you didn't know what that meant, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body. God tells him, I will establish his kingdom. And in verse 13, I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And verse 16, your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. There was some permanency starting to take place. For someone to reign forever, he would have to be immortal. Did David understand this to mean that he would have an immortal descendant? Well, yes, he did, because in Acts 2, verses 25 to 35, I'm just going to leave the scripture references up there. Feel free, just because of time, and it's not really all the focus, but go back and have a look. There's 10 verses there which talks about what I'm talking about right now. So in Acts 2, verses 25 to 35, Peter says to David, he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on the throne. See, David foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of Christ. Peter refers to David's writings in Psalms. David wrote a lot of Psalms. So even in that passage in Acts, it speaks about Psalm 16 and Psalm 110 of a king who would live forever and who could permanently reign over and protect God's people. So David knew that out of his descendants was going to come a permanent, was going to come an immortal, so to speak. Jesus is in total control. That was mentioned this morning, that Jesus is in total control. He governs all things and he's always there. In Luke 12, he told his disciples, do not fear those who kill the body and after that have nothing more that they can do. But I will warn you whom to fear. Fear him who after he has killed has authority to cast into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. Revere, have reverence for him. Are not five sparrows sold for 2 pennies? And not one of them is forgotten by God. Why, even the hairs on your head are numbered. Some are great numbered and some are very few. Fear not, you are of more value than the many sparrows. Jesus is the permanent protector and of his covenant people, now and forever. We must find our rest and hope in this very place. So even though this covenant was a long time ago, it has so much for us today. It's where we are now. We should have this understanding of who Jesus is in our life. We should live our lives this way. We should, if we have a true revelation and an understanding, We should understand that he is our great protector. That we should fear not, because he is with you. Do our actions, do our words reflect that? Do we even believe it? See, we can say it. We can write it on a card. You can write it in your notebook. But are we writing it on the tablets of our heart, so to speak? Have we allowed it to really permeate inside of who we are, to understand who this Jesus is, to understand why it's even in place, why these covenants have been so incredible? Do we even believe it? Does the way we use our time or our money demonstrate that we believe that Jesus is Lord over every square millimeter of the universe? It's challenging, isn't it? Well, I find it challenging. God provides his permanent protection through a king who reigns forever, and he graciously calls us to admit our fears and to rest in that very protection. What are you fearing this morning? The second is presence, permanent presence. Now, earlier in 2 Samuel 7, David says that he wants to build God a permanent house. The first two verses of 2 Samuel state, now when David lived in his house of the Lord, he had given him rest for all his surrounding enemies, because it was in a time of peace and rest. The king said to Nathan the prophet, see now, I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells in a tent. We spoke about it last week. We spoke about the presence of God being in a tent, yeah? Because they lived in a tent. Now David's living in a palace, and the presence of God is in a tent. The Ark of the Covenant was kept in a portable, a movable tabernacle. The ark held the tablets in which the Ten Commandments were written, and along with the tabernacle was a symbol of God's presence with Israel. David felt that God deserved a permanent house. Who wouldn't? Yeah? Than the one that was temporal. But Nathan tells David in verse 11, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. David just said that he has a house. So what was God saying there? If we look at verse 13 again, God says this permanent king who descends from David shall build a house for my name. A permanent house in verse 16. And your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever. It's a house for David, but also for God's name. What does this even actually mean? In those times, house was synonymous with dynasty. A dynasty is an era in which power and rule belong to one family. God promises David that he would be the first king of a dynasty that would never end. A dynasty that would never end. That's clear from God's statements about permanent kingdom. God's permanent presence would be with this everlasting dynasty. But we learn something else about the permanent place of God's presence on earth. David's son Solomon did build a temple. Eventually it was destroyed and then rebuilt, then destroyed again. Therefore, God had no permanent temple or house, no permanent place for his holy presence on earth. But then in 1 Corinthians 3, Paul tells the church, do you not know that you are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells within you? God's temple is holy, and you are that temple. It just unfolds right before your eyes. It just gets bigger and bigger. It gets more and more overwhelming. And then you see the grace of God more and more. And it should almost bring us to our knees. It really should, if we could get a grasp of how big this is. How incredible this is. And I don't want to steal too much from next week, but I know I'm going to wreck it. The permanent house of God is the church. It's not a building, but the people to whom His Holy Spirit dwells. Who knows what's on the front of this door outside, what the words are? Hope Chapel. A chapel is a place where the church gathers. This organization is called Hope Chapel, but we are Hope Church. You are Hope Church. I've always wanted a clear delineation between a building and its people. I always thought pastors were schizophrenic. Well, during the week, they'd invite other pastors, hey, do you want to come and see my church? But there was no people there during the week. But on a Sunday, the people are there. And then sometimes we'd say, come on, church, we need you to do this, this, and this. Well, hang on, you just said the church during the week was a building, so the building can't do anything. So can you please make your mind up? So can the building stand up? Or should the church stand up? It might be something really small, but it really meant something to me. Because I went through a time when I was confused with what the organization was. Was it a business? Was it this? Was it that? But then you get taken on this journey because of the grace of God. God unfolds and gives you a revelation of really what this is all about. We are what it's about. You are what it's about. All this story of redemption is not about building the best building. It's about you. It's about you and you and you. God's pursuit was not for real estate. God's pursuit is for your heart that was paid with a price that we can't afford because your heart is priceless. The real estate in your heart, no mogul, no rich entrepreneur could ever afford. Because your heart was bought with a price, and it was the blood of Jesus that was shed for your redemption in God's plan forever, forever. Forever, not temporal, but eternal. This is when the eternity starts to tip in. This is this hinge I was talking about. It's gone from here to something now, which is, oh my gosh, we've just opened the door to something which is so much more than I've ever realized before. Not a list of rules, not a list, not of that. But this, eternity. In Ephesians 2, Paul tells the church, you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In Him, you also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. The house that will stand forever, filled with the presence of God, is the true church, justified, sanctified, and glorified by Jesus Christ. It has nothing to do with buildings that people call churches. And when we see the word of church in the Bible, it doesn't mean building. The Greek word ecclesia just simply means public assembly or public gathering. I love it. Some churches want to make it fancy and they want to say, oh, we want to come to the ecclesia. Okay. It's a public gathering. Let's drop this pretentious stuff. It's a public gathering. In actual fact, if you go even before that, every city had a city square And that meeting was actually called Ecclesia. It actually, to start with, never had anything to do with the church. I just think we get so pompous and pious in all this stuff. It's a public gathering. We are the church. We are the Ecclesia, if you want to call it that way. If you want to be fancy. Jesus added to the meaning by using the word to describe the community, which he established and gave structure as he called people out of sin and into covenant relationship with God. And he is still doing that today. He's still doing that to people's lives today and everyone in here today. God provides his permanent presence through a house that stands forever. The local church is therefore a necessity in your life. I used to say that I was really passionate about the local church, but now I'm going to tell you it's a necessity in your life. Not a local building, but the local community of believers with whom God's Spirit dwells. Today, the individual's relationship with God has been elevated in such a way that some people think, and I know it's not anyone here, that the church is unnecessary for our Christian life. I'm sorry, it's wrong. There you go, I've said it. Finally said it after all 16 years. Finally said it. If you're a Christian, go to church. You need your fellow people around you. We become the church. Sure, you can miss it. Sure, you can have some time out. Sure, all the stuff happens in church. Let's just do a really quick raise. This is negative, but we'll finish on a positive. Who here has been hurt in the church before? Now look at the hands. Look at those ones. Yeah, me! Who's had the worst hurt? Me! Who's been offended the most in a church? Me! And that's why I love it. That is why I love it. I can be hurt outside the church, but church pain is so horrible. It's so sometimes intense, but the enemy uses it to make you run, to get yourself isolated, so you no longer become the church. Look at it for what it is. You don't have to be friends with everybody. I don't think it says that in the Bible, be a friend of everyone. You just got to love everyone. And I can love you because Jesus loved me first. If you lace it with that, you can love everyone. Les, I love you. Easy now. He's a new bloke now, isn't he? He's got no glasses. Look at him. He's got amazing eyesight. How many fingers? 8. God bless you, Les. I think you live forever. I think you got a dynasty going on. Again, in Ephesians 2, we are built together in a dwelling place for God. The church is the place where we worship together and we care for one another and we pay people out. No, and the church is the place where we encourage each other and spur each other on in God's grace and live for his glory. God graciously calls you to be a part of his church. You know, the discipleship course is about that, an invitation. It's an invitation to be a follower of Christ. If we understand what a follower, a wholehearted follower of Christ is and what it's about, it will lead you to church every single time. It'll lead you to God. I don't see that much difference. This is God's house. And if this is God's house and Jesus is the cornerstone or Jesus is the head, then why wouldn't I want to be here? Why wouldn't I want to be involved in a church? Third is love, and we'll wrap it up quick. Now, I said before that with prophecies, there were partial and complete fulfillments. 2 Samuel 7 prophecy has both partial and complete fulfillments. David's son Solomon did build a house for God, the temple in Jerusalem. And after David's death, there was other kings from his line who ruled before Israel was exiled into captivity in Babylon. They were David's house. They were David's dynasty. But verses 14 and 15 help see us another aspect of the partial and complete fulfillments and this bridge between the temporary and the permanent. Nathan quotes God's saying of David's descendants, "I will be to him a father and he shall be to me a son. When he commits iniquity, I will discipline him with the rod of men, with the stripes of the sons of men, but my steadfast love will not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you." God had a special enduring relationship with the kings in David's dynasty. And so he has a special enduring relationship with the people of their kingdom. The complete fulfillment of this prophecy is the coming of Jesus into the world. But if we look at verse 14, Jesus did not commit iniquity. He committed no sin. He had nothing, no sin attached to him. Therefore, he didn't deserve to be disciplined with the rod of men, with the stripes of the Son of Men. But the kings who came after David did need discipline. Some of them were bad kings, but sin didn't dissolve God's covenant relationship. I have an incredible thought in all of this that I can't really share because it's so out there. But when you start reading this, when you start to understand that, David prayed this prayer, David was known after God, being a man after God's own heart. And in Psalms, David prays this prayer about God grant me an undivided heart. An undivided heart. How can you have an undivided heart and yet commit the sins that David did? An undivided heart. I'll leave you to go down that rabbit, Warren, but I find it incredible. I think it's all attached to this Davidic covenant and the forever nature of it. Always there. Because I tell you what, when you read that, put a mirror up to your own life again. Put a mirror and look in that as well. And then you want to know that there's the grace of God for you. Yeah? Because who here has been saved, who has Jesus in their heart, and yet still has slipped up, has still done some things, yeah? You want the grace of God attached to that, yeah? We're a part of this forever covenant now. And it's really incredible, and it's so overwhelming, and that's why when I say about the grace of God, all of these promises in 2 Samuel 7 form a special covenant. And like all of the covenants before it, this part of the covenant reflects God's grace. Because as God says in verse 15, his steadfast love will not depart from him. The king represented the people, so the love of God would not depart from the people, even though they would commit sin. This steadfast love, the one that we enjoy, the one that we need, is very important to understand. It is God's unwavering covenant faithfulness towards the people he redeems. It's the favor that he extends to them, not because of their good works, not because you think you're good, but because he chose them and set his love upon them. The fact that God pledges grace to them ensures that he will never abandon them. And because God is a just God who must confront sin, the wrath that sin deserves would have to be put somewhere. The sons of David endured temporary God's discipline for their sins, but ultimately Jesus endured the discipline of the rod of men and bore the stripes of the sons of men in his death on the cross. He paid the penalty for the sins of those who lived before him, who lived for him, and for those who lived during and after his life and trust in him. The guys can come up. Again, there is temporal nature to everything in our lives. You clean your house, but before long you have to clean it again. You fix all your problems at work, and you can guarantee more problems will arise. Things break or wear out and have to be repaired or even replaced. Even the things that bring us the most excitement and joy are temporary. Children hope desperately for their birthdays or for Christmas, for gifts, only to receive it and eventually lose interest in it. We hope for the perfect job or the perfect home, but neither can last forever. We won't be strong and healthy forever. We won't have our full mental capacity forever. Family and friends grow older and pass away. Life itself comes to an end. But in covenant with God through Jesus Christ, we have permanent things. God provides his permanent love through a covenant that lasts forever. God is committed to those in covenant with him, even though we don't deserve it. The unmerited favor of God. No rebellious plot can overthrow Jesus. He's our protector. No siege can destroy the house where his presence dwells. And no failure on our part can remove his love. I hope that today you can receive and rest in that. I hope that you can receive it and rest in that. I hope you can be comforted more by his grace in this year ahead, looking forward. Believe in Jesus today, for his is the power and the kingdom and the glory forever. Thank you for coming out. I hope that you're able to get something out of that today. I hope that you can go back and re-look at his word and see how incredible that it is, and how it unfolds and brings us to this place of the forever. Forever his grace, his love, his protection, and his presence. God bless you and thank you. Have a great rest of your day. Looking forward to seeing you at Easter.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the message this week.